Hello, Başak. So nice to see you. It's been a while, huh? Last time we recorded an episode was on 7 December last year, which is 328 days ago, almost a year. How have you been?
Wow, that's a long time. It's been a memorable year for me, for sure. I moved. It's my first time living in an English-speaking country, and therefore my accent is going through puberty. I'll ask for some lenience from our listeners. But also, I've been quite depressed. April through August was really difficult. And this might come as a surprise to some, because while I was in the deep of it, I wasn't able to speak much about it. But since then, I've bounced back. What about you?
Yeah, it's great that you bounced back. Well, there has been a lot in my life since then, too. I defended my thesis at the end of February. And then 3 days later, Russia invaded my country. And this has been a huge shock for me and a shake, you know, the one that split things into before and after. And as our listeners could imagine, that was the primary reason why we took a pause with the podcast. So my priority has been helping my country as much as I can and our military primarily in financial way. And I did not have much of a headspace for philosophy of international law. And by the way, since the war continues, if you want to offer some support, we will leave some links to trusted charities in the description. Any help is really appreciated, even a little bit helps. But now we're back with the podcast, and we hope that you missed us.
Yes, we are, and we are very excited to introduce some novelties to our podcasts. First of all, we are moving towards a more flexible schedule. Unlike in previous seasons, we will release episodes somewhat less frequently, but we will, of course, keep you updated with announcements. So if you don't follow us on Twitter yet, now's the time.
Right. And we're also working on something entirely different, a new format, if you will, in addition to our usual interview episodes. We will share some more details separately, but we are super excited to bring something fresh and flashy.
But I guess enough with the preliminaries. If you haven't realized yet, you are listening to Borderline Jurisprudence. I am Başak Etkin. On my screen is Kostya Gorobets, and we are back.
Yes, and our guest today is Başak Çalı, professor of international law at the Hertie School and co-director of School Center for Fundamental Rights. One of the unique features of Professor Çalı is that her scholarship deals with so many different topics, from authority of international law and interpretivism to international human rights law. She is a philosopher of international law, but she is also a practicing human rights lawyer. Başak Çalı, welcome.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here with you, Başak and Kostya. And hopefully, Kostya, you will understand that I'm very excited to be with another Başak as well. So a little bit excited for that.
Yeah, for me, this is also a very special experience to have two Başaks on my screen at the moment and having this wonderful conversation. And I'm also very excited to have you on our podcast because your 2015 book, The Authority of International Law, Obedience, Respect, and Rebuttal, was the book that inspired my PhD thesis when I was writing my PhD proposal in 2017. I read your book and I find it so amazing and so insightful that I decided to write on Authority of International Law as well. So that's how I ended up doing my own research. And this book is, well, perhaps the most complete and innovative piece on authority of international law. And your main argument is that international law has practical authority over domestic legal systems and officials, but this authority is relative. So legal obligations that international law produces differ in strength and the kind of a response from domestic legal systems. And to me, this sounds like, okay, many skeptics could immediately raise the red flag that, okay, relative authority is not like real authority. And that when international law fails to secure the obligation of obedience, its claim of authority is just an empty sound. So how does your view of authority of international law address these concerns? So would you say that the move towards a more relative conception of practical authority in a way enables this skeptical challenge that international law constantly faces?
Thank you, Kostia. And I know that this is an audio podcast, and I wish that your global audience could have seen the big smile on my face when you said that a little book that I wrote actually inspired you. So I still have a big smile on my face. Maybe the audience could visualize that. So as you underlined also in the question, my aim in authority of international law was really to make sense of the authority of international law over domestic legal systems, that is domestic courts and parliaments. So in that sense, this book was interested in a very particular form of authority relationship, that is the relationship between domestic authorities and international law. And of course, there are lots of other relationships or other authority relationships. For example, we could think of the authority of international law over international organizations or over individuals. But this book was not about those. So I think that's an important starting point. So with that in mind, because I was interested in the authority of international law over other legal authorities, I insisted that a good starting point for that would be the structure of legal obligations that we find in international law, regardless of what the formal sources which generate those obligations. And I differentiate between strong, weak, and rebuttable obligations, and in turn say that domestic authorities would then have to respond to the authority of international law in a variable way, depending on whether the obligation is strong. So if it's a very clear prohibition of a certain conduct or a norm that mandates a very specific conduct, or whether the norm actually leaves domestic authorities a lot of options as to how they discharge their obligations to respect international law. And of course, I also talk about these rebuttable obligations, that obligations that can be rebutted by domestic authorities by justifying that rebuttal with other weighty legal reasons that may be at work. So this is kind of the gist of the argument. So then how do I answer to the skeptics? This is the heart of your question. And I think this depends on what kind of skeptics we talk about, right? So perhaps let's start with friendly skeptics to this very particular account. So I suppose if you were a friendly skeptic of the argument in authority of international law, so you would agree that, look, yes, we agree that there are different structures of obligations in international law. They are not all the same type of obligations that you have to follow X. So hopefully, they would agree with me until that point. And that it is very important to know which structure is at stake. So is it, do X in order to respect A, you can do A, B, C, D, E, F, G, or, you could actually rebut it and so on. So perhaps the friendly skeptic may say that I'm a bit too optimistic about how to differentiate between strong, weak, and rebuttable obligations. So they could say, look, domestic authorities can frame international law obligations as they please. And, what you think is a strong obligation, I don't know, prohibition of genocide. I mean, that's a tough one. I suppose for the friendly skeptic, they could have, saying, well, in order to discharge that, they could have lots of different things that they can do and so on and so forth, so that I don't really resolve the problem by imposing these types of structures. So I think they would probably say that I'm too trusting of domestic authorities to take international law seriously and to make sense of the structural obligations in international law. So I think we can talk further with the friendly skeptics. I think, I think the conversation can productively continue because I think that, there is a justificatory duty on domestic legal authorities to make sense of international law. And I think that most domestic legal authorities would agree with me that there is some sense of a justificatory obligation. So I would say that, the risk of abuse or risk of uncertainty does not sort of affect what I think is a more sophisticated general argument to understand the authority of international law, because I think this winner takes all view about international law is just not very tenable if we really try to make sense of the authority of international law departing from its practice as such. Now, maybe the second type of skepticism is people who are skeptic about the authority of international law all the way down. And here I don't have a lot to contribute because for these skeptics, international law is always rebuttable. So they think that the only obligation that international law generates are rebuttable obligations. I think that's another way of putting deep skepticism about international law. And I think that my account in Authority of International Law cannot satisfy these skeptics because it says that, you know, there's a very basic presumption to take international law and what it has generated seriously. And I'm not so sure if any account of Authority of International Law can satisfy deep skeptics.
Yeah, this is an interesting point because as I understand, the sort of rebuttable obligations that international law generates, as I remember, you also give examples from human rights law specifically. So for instance, margin of appreciation, I think, is a kind of a concept that grew around rebuttable obligations. And I like the way that you frame this distinction between friendly skeptics and not very friendly skeptics, and that for not a very friendly skeptic, any obligation is rebuttable in a way. But would you agree that different areas of international law may rely more on this strong obligations versus the areas that rely more on rebuttable obligations and therefore leave more of a space for states to feel with their own concerns and reasons? So if we put it in Rayleighian terms, yeah, so these rebuttable obligations, they, in a sense, less exclusionary. Would you agree on that?
Yes, I think that's a healthy way, or I think it's a good way to think about. So think about, you know, structures of obligations sectorally, right? Or looking at different areas or branches of international law. But I wouldn't sort of immediately jump to the conclusion that, you know, certain areas invite more rebuttable and other areas less, because I think we also have to take into account sort of the dynamic evolution of international law. And I'm also not necessarily of the opinion that, you know, the international law will evolve in rebuttable things becoming stronger obligations, because sometimes we may also think that what is posed as strong obligations could be better as rebuttable obligations. So I think that there is a bit of a movement between these types of obligations. And you mentioned international human rights law, and those who are not familiar with international human rights law may think that it's an area full of very strong obligations. But obviously, when you study international human rights law very closely, you will see that these three structures of obligations are very alive and present, and all the constructions around absolute rights, qualified rights, are also really, they actually do speak to these kind of questions and these notions of qualifiers of rights in particular. To say, oh, here is a field, international human rights law or international humanitarian law, where all obligations of a certain kind, I think they would need a lot more closer scrutiny. But I think it's helpful to think about these structures of obligations when we think about the authority of international law. I think it's helpful to me not to think about that in the abstract, but actually in this more diversified way.
And since we're on the topic of human rights a little bit, despite this book that was quite theoretical and general international law, you do write a lot on human rights law, and especially on the European Convention Court of Human Rights. And this is an area and a court that has pushed us to reconsider some of the most infamous questions around the place of the individual in international law, or enforceability of decisions and regional variations of interpretation of rights. What do you think are the key philosophical, and if not philosophical, maybe theoretical, challenges that are specific to human rights law and that are in a way amplified maybe in human rights law?
Thank you, Başak. And of course, I'm very happy to repeat this name very, very many times. It's so delightful to say thank you, Başak. We had a little conversation earlier, and Kostia thought that, you know, Başak was a very common name in Turkish, and it isn't. So it's very precious.
Shout out to Başak Bağlayan, the third international law, Başak.
Exactly. I think I'm very excited about this proliferation, or how you call it, of Başaks in this field. But coming back to your very important question, Başak. So maybe I'd like to first rephrase a little bit your question, because I think it may be helpful to narrow it down to talk about key philosophical challenges to human rights law, rather than sort of couple it with key philosophical challenges in relation to human rights. So this will be my first starting point, because human rights law has different types of philosophical challenges than moral human rights, or if you want to call it, there are different philosophical challenges that could be associated with legal human rights than with moral human rights. And of course, moral and political philosophers have been dealing extensively with challenges in relation to moral human rights. And we are always in a sort of a cross-fertilization. You know, it is a common, you can say that, well, there are lots of exchanges between these things as well. But the reason that I'm kind of starting with this is that actually one of the key philosophical challenges in the field of human rights law, as I see it, is how we view the relationship between legal human rights and moral human rights. I think this is one of the most crucial questions, because you can have more than one view about how we understand that relationship. And the way that we understand that relationship has huge implications for interpretation of human rights law, or trying to understand its object and purpose, and so on. So, you know, some would argue that, you know, human rights law is just an extension or a transposition of moral rights to law, right? That could be one view. Or others would think that legal human rights and moral human rights are two different things. They're two separate domains, and they attract different kind of philosophical questions as well. And that distinction is crucial, I think, in what we do in relation to this question. So I think I'm in the latter camp. So I think that it is helpful to think about legal human rights as a more distinct kind of field than you know, just an extension of moral human rights. And of course, if you think like that, the kinds of philosophical questions that you will worry about are quite different in that sense. So I think this is one of the biggest sort of very important philosophical problems that we genuinely face. I mean, you could say, well, is that just about human rights law? Aren't there other areas that we would have to worry about these issues? And of course, yes, but I think this is very amplified. And you were asking about what are things that are amplified in this particular field as well. So a second, maybe more particular problem that also ties in with our discussions of authority of international law is this philosophical problem about the authority of human rights law, legitimacy, authority of human rights law, and human rights courts, or you know, judicial review that's carried out by human rights courts. And that's also a very general problem about the authority of international law, but it's genuinely amplified because we do have regional human rights courts, and we have to think about their authority, and we have to talk about the authority of their judgments, and so on. Perhaps a third very interesting problem is that is also amplified quite a lot in this field is the interactions, or how do we make sense of the existence of regional human rights law versus general international human rights law or UN human rights law, right? Because we have all these different legal things, and it is not necessarily very clear how they all relate to each other. So you might say that while this maps onto questions familiar to moral theories about universality or relativity, but I think when you frame them as legal / philosophical questions, you would find more problems or different answers to those well-known questions about universality or relativity of human rights as well. So these are just a few, but I think you're absolutely spot on that human rights law amplifies maybe because we have quite a lot of it. We have its courts, we have its judgments. It really is a field where a lot of philosophical questions are genuinely amplified in this particular domain. Yeah.
Speaking of amplification, and maybe moving a little bit back to philosophy, in 2009, you published a very insightful paper, which was called On Interpretivism and International Law, where you highlighted some ideas from Ronald Dworkin's theory of law as relevant for international law. So you wrote on Dworkin and international law 3 years before Dworkin wrote something on international law himself. And there you make a claim that although Dworkin's law as integrity conception does not quite work in international law in full, there is still some room for his interpretivist outlook, broadly speaking. So do you think Dworkin got it right about international law? Because I think why I said amplification, because I think his paper on international law somehow amplified the weak spots of his conception of law. So how does his own attempt to apply elements of his theory to international legal domain compare to yours? And why do you think it is the case that we now see sort of a revival of interest toward Dworkin's in philosophy of international law 10 years after his seminal paper?
Okay, so of course you could imagine, you know, when I wrote this piece, Interpretivism in International Law, I was, you know, writing it, going it, you know, having gone it, it has gone through peer review and things, and I was just like, well, you know, I haven't, you know, I'm writing about something that Dworkin hasn't written about. So what is this supposed to mean? And of course, obviously, I didn't write an interpretive theory about international law in that article, right? Because it was an incredibly modest attempt. And the main purpose of this article was to make sense of something that I thought was a puzzle. You know, there's a lot of, it was a big revival of theory in international law. There's been a proliferation of work, positivist, anti-positivist, critical in that period. But there was not a lot of interest about interpretivism, even though this was a very lively domain of jurisprudence in the standard case or in the domestic case. So for me, that was a puzzle. So I wanted to just answer the question about why international legal theory steered so clear from interpretivism and how to make sense of it. So in that piece, I try to answer that question in particular, and I provide some external and internal kind of reasons as to why I think this may be the problem. But in that piece, I really drew liberally on Dworkin's discussions of interpretivism. And in a way, the way that I tried to approach interpretivism was more as a method of normative reasoning and not as a substantive theory, because I think interpretivism has these two very important aspects to it. One is that it's a normative method, and the other one is that if you can run with that method and you can offer a substantive theory, because all legal theory is a faculty of political morality, and you have to work it out and offer obviously arguments in that sense. So that work was not really about second guessing anything that Dworkin might have said substantively on international law. But in that piece, one little thing that I did highlight was that sort of Dworkin's view about law in a single political community, law as integrity, maybe could not travel well as it is. So that sort of a transplant kind of an idea of let's have some of these ideas and then, you know, run with it to international law, I thought was not the way to become an interpretivist in international law. So it was a call about taking the method seriously and, you know, saying, well, you know, let's see what comes out of it. Now you can imagine how excited I was to then read a substantive interpretivist account of interpretivism, international law, and by no less than Dworkin himself, right? I mean, this was sort of, you know, that moment where you sit in a quiet room and, you know, you're like reading line by line about what what substance really comes there. So it was a very precious sort of moment. But I suppose we could, we have to be really careful in interpreting that piece, because probably that piece was the beginning of something. There's nothing else. It was probably a draft. I'm not so sure how polished it was, or you know how many times it was debated and discussed. So it was probably a start of something, and it did lots of different things in it. So the paper, you know, is quite multi-dimensional. So that could explain why the interest in that paper is very difficult to kind of, you know, that it was not discussed for a few years and then it was over, because the amount of substantive normative discussions in it are so wide ranging that, you know, anyone who would pick it up would, you know, continue even 10 years or 15 years later to say, you know, what do I make sense? How do I make sense of this? Especially if it's because it's written by Dworkin himself. But I had a couple of observations about this piece, and I still, I think, have them. So one thing that I noticed in my mind was that Dworkin did not strictly follow what I understood as the interpretivist method in that piece. So, you know, and you can say, how is this possible? You know, the master of the method, you know. I mean, I cannot see it very clearly in the piece. So I can't see how the puzzle kind of comes together there. So as far as I understand it, in the interpretivist method, you first identify the type of the practice that you're engaged in, and then you aim to present that practice in its best possible light. And this identification of the type of practice is a very big aspect of it, right? I mean, because you can't do the second step, the justificatory step, before identifying the practice and discussing it. And of course, we know that Dworkin never developed a list of necessary or sufficient conditions of how you identify the practice and then how you, you know, understand the fit of it. But we, I think the method shows us that, you know, we first really identify the role of the practice in the domain that it operates, right? So there's, these are really key words for me. What is the domain and how it operates in that domain? And then move to the point of having the practice. And then thinking through the difference of this practice from other practices that may seem similar, and think about the added value of the practice and things like that. So those are the things I wanted to read through, maybe, because that's how I had imagined that that he would work through the piece. But the piece doesn't start like that. So it doesn't start with discussing the role of the practice, and it kind of has a lot of shortcuts, I think. You know, it quickly criticizes existing positivist approaches and so on, and then sort of dies, I think, a little too quickly into the point of having the practice, and it's a singular value that is sort of imposed on the practice. So I was missing the discussion about this practice, because I think international law is quite a wild beast, and there may be lots of points of this practice. And of course, the unity of value thesis of Dworkin tries to make sense of how competition between different values comes about to a certain unity of value. And I think in that piece, we don't see that. Maybe he has done it in his head, you know, maybe he has thought through it, but that's something that I missed very much in that piece. So the second sort of interesting thing about the piece is that it's fantasy court point, so that the piece imagines that there is an international court with compulsory jurisdiction and with enforceable rulings and things like that. And I think in the interpretivist account, you know, you wouldn't impose a fantasy court. I mean, I thought that this was very surprising, because we had to make sense of what we have and the point of what we have. And in the standard domestic case, there are no fantasy courts, you know, that there are these courts. So I think this piece was not interpretivist enough for me, if that makes sense. I think it was a much more of an idealized kind of account and not an interpretivist one. Of course, saying this is, you know, how can you say to the interpretivist that they are not interpretivist enough is probably, you know, is probably, you know, a big word to say. This general structural principle that Dworkin has as well, that he introduces us, that there is one very general structural principle, which is that international law is there to mitigate the imperfections of the sovereign state system. And I also couldn't understand why this was the general structural principle. So, you know, what were the other principles, or what were the other questions that were discarded? You know, how did we reach to that principle was something that I also found challenging in that piece. So a lot of surprises, I think, in that article for me, but also a lot of unanswered questions. And I also agree with a line of broad criticism that was made of the Dworkinian interpretivist world, is that it's a world where all states are aspiring to be liberal democratic states, or that's kind of the sense that you guess, because the structural principle of mitigation is there because all states are trying to improve their political legitimacy, and engaging with international law is part of also engaging with the political legitimacy of a state. And I could think of, you know, various counter arguments to that, because some aspects of international law, such as international refugee law, for example, is precisely there because not all states seek to advance their political legitimacy. So it compensates for the lack of, rather than some other way around. So I would have thought that, yeah, working maybe through different bits of international law, different object and, you know, different purposes that are scattered around international law, sort of juxtaposing them and then trying to maybe make sense of them, you know, by actually thinking through some very competing values that are maybe part of the practice, would have been a better way out. But we have, I think, still a very fascinating piece, and I think it still is a very important piece, because it squarely is worried about one particular legal problem, which is non-consensualism and how we make sense of non-consensualism in international law. So I'm not surprised at all that this piece continues to receive a lot of attention, because it speaks to a lot of fundamental legal questions. Now, whether it offers us the interpretivist account of international law, I'm not so sure, but I think it's a genuine invitation to lots of others who'd like to think through not only his substantive views, but also his methods, which I think were incredibly significant contribution to legal theory.
Yeah, these are fascinating thoughts. And I totally agree with you that paper is so incredibly rich and on many accounts very problematic, as you identified yourself, that indeed there is no surprise that people continue to get back to it. And what you said earlier in your answer, that, yeah, there is a problem with how he applies his own interpretivist outlook to international law without actually identifying the practice, or kind of saying what the practice is about, what it consists of. I wonder if that could be because, in his own words, he calls international law to be fragile, nascent, and in critical condition, right? So maybe there isn't really actual practice yet, and that's why we need to sort of invent this court in order to have a glimpse of how this practice could look like. So it is an interesting twist to his interpretivist method, in a sense that he sort of starts from the other, one could say, the wrong end, yeah, so from the justificatory end. So how would this imaginary court could construct the practice and justify it, rather than going out there and trying to construct the practice himself? Would you agree with that?
Yes, I think you're spot on, Kostya, because I mean there is a reason why the steps are reversed, as you put it. But we don't really get a good sense of why exactly. I mean, I don't get a good sense of why it is the case. Because perhaps, again, I have a lot more of an optimistic, perhaps, or a lot more of a fuller understanding or expectation that there is a practice, right? So I think that comes to a very fundamental question about, you know, what constitutes a practice and whether international law meets with that. So then he shares a lot of similarities with some perhaps international law skeptics as well, at his sort of starting points or his initial positions as well. And perhaps looking at it from, you know, say from the room of international law, is something that I found slightly disappointing, that was his view looking from out from his domestic standard case, and that's all he saw as international law. So I think there seems to be always the discrepancy between standard case theorists and maybe international legal theorists, that looking from the other side, this doesn't seem to be very easy to comprehend what we're trying to understand or make sense of. And that problem seems to be reflected in a lot of the philosophical work that we see coming through, you know, how the journey of domestic jurisprudence traveling to international law. Yeah, absolutely.
From the deep ends of jurisprudence, we will now maybe ask the least theoretical question we've ever asked on the podcast, because we rarely have the opportunity to have someone who also practices international law, given our area of interest. But you have most notably pleaded before the European Court of Human Rights in cases like Selahattin Demirtas and Osman Kavala, and recently submitted an amicus brief before the US Supreme Court. How do you think your academic interests in philosophy of international law and human rights law inform your outlook in legal practice? Does it ever help, or maybe on the contrary, not help?
No, that's a great question. I think I practice tiny bit of international law. I wouldn't call that I practice lots of it, but thank you for that question, Bashak. So maybe for the global audience that you have, you know, it might be helpful to just say a couple of little words about these two cases that you mentioned, the Demirtas and the Kavala cases. So both of these cases were against Turkey, and they were both before the European Court of Human Rights. And they both concern deprivation of liberty of these two men. And Demirtas not anymore, the leader of the leftist Kurdish political party. And at the time, it was the second largest opposition party in the country when he was imprisoned. And Kavala is a human rights defender. And both of them are still in prison, despite European Court of Human Rights judgments. Demirtas is now in prison for about 6 years and Kavala for 5 years. So the European Court of Human Rights judgments that I helped both of them to receive hasn't really led to any form of individual justice for them. And in the case of Kavala, maybe that's also of interest, that the Council of Europe Committee of Ministers initiated infringement proceedings for the second time in its history. And that is a significant legal development in this case. Now, maybe more significantly, what brought me into these cases, in particular to these cases, had to do with my own research. So this is how I actually had roles in these two cases. And my current research is very interested in questions about ulterior purpose or bad faith in international law. So the concepts of bad faith, I mean, we have a lot of research on good faith, obviously, in international law, but you know, whether bad faith is just the opposite of or lack of, or whether it's something else. And of course, these ideas about what is an ulterior purpose in international law, these are exceptionally under-theorized and understudied areas. You know, we think that these are not the biggest kind of theoretical conceptual questions in international law. So my research in these questions brought me to these cases, because both of these cases concern arguments with respect to the restriction of liberty of these two individuals to pursue ulterior purposes, or detentions in bad faith, if you want to call it that way. And in both cases, the European Court of Human Rights found what we call an Article 18 violation, which means that the restrictions of rights pursued ulterior purposes under the European Convention. So this is an extraordinary, I think, legal development. So the legal sort of development of these cases, or the bad faith jurisprudence, if you want to call it, or ulterior purpose conceptualization, the practice is a little bit ahead of the theory or conceptual development in these cases. So I find this an extraordinarily important area, actually, to think through. So my interest in these kind of more conceptual questions about what is bad faith or what is an ulterior purpose, how you conceptualize it, how you prove it. So these types of questions directly influenced my legal advocacy work in both of these cases. So you could see that there was an instrumental relationship between my interest in concepts and some of the work that I did in relation to litigation. And I'm very pleased, obviously, that this work has helped in both cases successful outcomes for these individuals. But it's important to note that this only is now a jurisprudential success and not any meaningful success for either of the individuals. So yeah, being interested in theory, and I suppose, you know, in the spirit of your title of your podcast, Borderline Jurisprudence, I suppose I'm a borderline theorist, right? I was thinking about that, you know, could you be somebody who's at the borderline of things? So my sort of principled interest in theory and concepts have really helped in thinking through these cases. But of course, that's not enough for legal advocacy. That's not the skill that would succeed. There's lots of other work that comes with legal argumentation and skill. But one of the things, of course, interest in theory really helps is that you really are able to construct things very clearly. You really consider objections, counterpoints to a particular definition of a concept and how it's used. And you're really constantly able to think about, you know, what will be the objections, how could they be countered? So these types of discipline of thinking and training and clarification of concepts and so on were incredibly valuable. But I, of course, I wouldn't say that legal theory is only instrumentally valuable. It's also non-instrumentally valuable. But in these cases, it was indeed also instrumentally very valuable. And the doctrinal and the theoretical work were mutually supportive of one another, which is not necessarily always the case, of course.
Which brings us to our speed round. So these are the three questions we ask all of our guests. And the first one is, what drives you to do what you do, academically speaking?
Okay, so I think I'm genuinely constantly inspired by our collective ability to co-produce knowledge. I find this so inspiring. So what do I mean by that? So we're able to better understand concepts, and we're able to do it collectively. And you know, just reading and understanding how people thought before me, they're way, you know, dead centuries ago, perhaps sometimes, and that you're able to be in conversations with people who are no longer there and sort of understand what their theoretical struggles were, what concepts they were, you know, trying to make sense of and struggle with, and that we're actually be able to be in this scholarly, you know, conversation, I find this incredibly inspiring. So I don't mean to say that I'm only inspired by dead people or anything like that. So even this podcast and the questions that you set for me, you know, in order to answer in this podcast, I was so inspired by the questions. I was like, wow, you know, this is just so incredible that, you know, there's this genuine opportunity for co-production of knowledge. You made me think about things in ways. So I find these things incredibly, incredibly inspiring. I like ideas and ability to better understand them collectively. Incredibly inspiring.
Thank you. Thank you for the nice compliment in your answer. But I guess with the inspiration of ideas and us doing this collectively, well, to each their demons, what is something you struggle with?
Oh, this was an easy one for me. This question was easy. So I don't know why, but I seek to remain a generalist, whatever that means, of international law and international human rights law as well. And I'd like to imagine myself as someone who has one foot in doctrine and one foot in real world implications of law and one foot in theory. And, you know, try to imagine myself in this kind of way is incredibly challenging because it's a constant challenge to keep abreast with all of these things at the same time. And you would always wonder, you know, do I do justice to one or the other one? Because these are, important activities, and they are sometimes compatible, but not necessarily at all times. So, but then, of course, I try to rebut, sometimes some demon in me says you have to stop, you know, trying to do all these things and you have to just do one. Of course, I have an objection from the other side, and you know, they say, well, you know, this is great. You have to, you know, this is, you have to stay in this way. So I think it's very safe to stay in boxes, in silos of work, theory, practice, doctrine, law in context, and things like that. And of course, it gets very messy if you try to open a lot of boxes and you want to sort of see what's all in them and how they connect and things like that. It's a big struggle. But I think I enjoy it. Yeah.
It's always so... The answers we get to these questions are always so deep, right? And it makes us think about our own struggles or inspirations. And your answer goes to something that I struggle with, as in, I always felt like doing theory meant sort of being disconnected from the reality of things a little bit. And I know that Kostya feels that way too, that he wants more of an, he wants to see what he's doing, the impact of it at least. And I guess my take on that is, I'm in that little box of theory where it's really comfortable, and I really am scared to go out because it's, I feel like it's so difficult to juggle all these, which is what you said you struggle with, right? Because so it proves my point that it's really difficult. So now it only makes me want to stay in here longer and under the blankets of my security blanket theory.
Theory also has cookies, right? So, so you can stay under the blanket with cookies.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of, I mean, in my situation, at least, it's how I deal with the world, because the world is a lot to take in. So in my work, I sort of stay in this safe place under the covers and anyways.
I really like your comment, but theory is not a safe place. Huh?
I mean, it's true that there are demons.
it's also a very challenging space, I think. But we should talk more about this.
Yeah. Last but obviously not least, what is a book or an article that you think everyone should read?
So I am going to, I listened to the podcast and you say that a lot of people struggle with it. This is a tough question, who to choose, how to choose, what to say, and so on and so forth. And first, I'd like to say that it is a tough question, right? I mean, it's like, you know, what you thought about that morning, or, you know, is that a book that I've thought about many, many years? But I actually did some research about you guys as well when you invited me to this podcast, and I was reading what you've been writing and what you've been thinking. So the piece that I read is The Solidarity as a Practical Reason.
Granted, oh no.
Of international law. So I've done some background research and some good reading. So this is an EUI working paper. I don't know if you can correct me if it's published elsewhere in 2022. And why do I nominate this paper? Because this paper spoke to me in so many different ways. So as you will all read now, Kostya's paper discusses the concept and the principle of solidarity in international law. And it also aims to identify the normative function of solidarity in international law. Firstly, this is incredibly timely. There is a lot of solidarity talk And obviously, philosophers or legal theorists are exceptionally best placed when there's a talk about something, because talk about something means not much if you don't know what you're talking about. So from that perspective, if you want to understand anything about solidarity in international law, you have to read this paper, because it starts with a very nice sort of discussion of the development of the idea of solidarity. But that's not the reason to read this paper, or not definitely the only reason, because the piece is fantastic because it asks a very important question. It says what it means to call a concept a principle of international law. So again, you know, we throw this word around all the time, you know, what is the principle of international law? And again, so it opens you another box, if you will. So it unpacks the box of solidarity and then this notion of a principle, and also what normative functions principles serve. So this is the part that I think enjoyed the most in this paper. And one of the greatest gems in the paper is also the distinction it makes between normative principles and legally normative principles, which I thought was a very smart, sophisticated move. So the argument of the paper is that solidarity is not and should not, so it's a is not and a should not paper, be considered as a principle, a legal normative principle of international law, but it actually performs, regardless of that, that it actually is capable of performing a normative function. So I genuinely recommend this this article to everybody. I think it's inspiring. It's, you learn a lot from it, but also you are able to think with Kostia on some very key questions about solidarity, but also about principles. So very strongly recommended.
What a spotlight. Thank you so much. I'm really, really flattered that you recommend my paper.
Well, you've completely ruined this question for any future guests, you know? Yes. Now we will be expecting everyone to do the same thing.
Yeah, that's the end of it. No, but thank you so much. Yeah, I'm really flattered.
No, I did research, right? I listened to your podcast. I analyzed different ways of how this was done, and I decided to do it this way. There you go. And it was very enjoyable to read it as well.
Thank you.
I agree. I mean, all of Kostia's papers to me are...
Stop it. Yeah, I think on this very high note, we can say thank you very much, Bashak Chali, for joining us for this episode of the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure to read your questions and talk about them.